The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
I think as some of you, and many of you know, I translated an ancient Buddhist text called the Dhammapada. And partly I translated it because I'm very fond of this text. It's a text which is 423 verses, that many of them supposedly go back to the Buddha, and some of them probably come from other sources. But in the centuries after the Buddha, there was a custom in India of compiling verses and verse anthologies. And there were a variety of these verse anthologies that existed at the time. And the one that comes down to us in our tradition is called the Dhammapada. And it's considered by many to be one of the great classics of religious literature. And there are something like 50 at least English translations. So I added to a crowded field. And I translated it mostly for my own study, for my own engagement in this text and in this tradition. And I still, even having translated, I still find it very nice to go back and reread. And sometimes I'm surprised what I read in here, even though I translated it. And I think of it as like mostly four-line verses, and little verses that have these wisdom teachings. And wisdom teachings are teachings which it's useful to go back to over and over again, and have kind of blossom in the mind, digest in the mind, percolate in the mind in various ways, and kind of new understandings arise as they kind of sit there and go through. And so I wanted to try this morning to give a presentation, a talk on the Dharma of the Dhammapada, kind of the teachings of the Dhammapada, by reading a series of verses from here. And one of the things I'll say, further say as introduction, is that when I encounter a text like this, I think of the lineage of practitioners down through the centuries that have brought the Buddha's teachings to me or to us, and that it's not just something that appeared out of nowhere, but there's a very rich kind of lineage, very rich tradition that it's part of. And the expression that I like for that lineage is warm hand to warm hand. That somehow Buddhism is transmitted, its teachings, the practices, from one person to another. It kind of is a living tradition, warm hand to warm hand. And you go back to these verses, and in my mind, in my kind of imagination, I imagine a little bit that it goes back to a tradition of monks, nuns, teachers, the Buddha, who sat a lot in the forest. And a time before there were cell phones and computers and electricity and the speed of our kind of life. And they sat I imagine these beautiful openings, sunny openings in the forest, and there underneath the shade of one tree would be sitting the Buddha or some person like him. And in that kind of very peaceful, natural setting, we would hear these kinds of teachings. And one of the verses in Dhammapada says, "Better than 1,000 meaningful verses is one meaningful verse which, having been heard, brings peace." So, if I would do just the right one for you, I'd read that one. And but again, here we're pointing to the kind of the function of these verses. The function of the verses is not only to bring some wisdom and to our lives and reflection to our lives, but also hopefully to bring some peace, which is one of the hallmarks of Buddhist practice. The aim is peace. And then this idea of being in the forest. There's a verse here. Reading part of it, "Delightful are forests. There the passion-free delight. Delightful are the forests. There the passion-free delight." Those are freed of passion, like lust. They delight in the forest. So, One of the interesting things about this text is that there's about 10% of the verses, so almost 40 of the verses, focus on happiness. And sometimes that's lost sight of, because there's all kinds of different teachings in here. And different Western translators have translated this text differently as well. And sometimes their philosophy, their worldview, it comes through in the translation. It's not really, it doesn't really represent the Buddha. And you find some of the translations are quite world-negating in a way that I believe is not in the original at all, having gone through the original text in Pali and translated it. Though you could say, well, Gil, you probably your bias has come through, your translation. But I tried very hard not to have my bias come through. You can't argue the fact that 10% or so of the verses are talking about happiness. They're happy verses. One who drinks in the Dharma. One who drinks in the Dharma. And what you don't know, because you don't know Pali, is that the word for drink is piti. And piti also means joy. So there's a word play here. One who enjoys the Dharma, one who drinks the Dharma. One who drinks in the Dharma sleeps happily with a clear mind. The sage always delights in the Dharma taught by the noble ones. Ah, so happily we live without hate among those with hate. Ah, so happily we live without misery among those in misery. Ah, so happily we live without ambition among those with ambition. Ah, so happily we live, we who have no attachments, we shall feast on joy as the radiant gods. So these are happy people. They're happy. And so, in a sense, happiness is a timeless issue. You know, even though this was maybe written 2,400, 2,500 years ago, happiness is still an issue. In fact, there are a whole industry now on books on happiness and a variety of things. It's become quite popular, the study of it. And something like the Dhammapada is meaningful as a religious classic because the teachings are kind of timeless. They're as relevant then as they are now. One more happy verse. Rouse yourself. Don't be negligent. Live the Dharma, a life of good conduct. One who lives the Dharma is happy in this world and the next. So 10% of the verses have to do with happiness. Another big percentage of them, I didn't count how many, have to do with related states. And one of the most common ones is peace. Peace is kind of held up as being kind of a high ideal or value in this tradition. A monk, filled with delight and pleased with the Buddha's teachings, attains happiness, the stilling of formations, the state of peace. Tasting the flavor of solitude and peace, one becomes free of distress and evil, drinking the flavor of Dharma joy. Peaceful in body, peaceful in speech, the monastic peacefully and well concentrated, who has rejected the world's bait, is called one at peace. Rejecting the world's bait. Now, some people might see that as being world negating. But what's this thing about the bait of the world? The world's a good place, right? Well, there's no shortage of temptation out there. There's other things besides bait, but we bite and then we hurt. Calm in mind, speech, and action, and released through right understanding, such a person is fully at peace. So happiness and peace. So this text, that's kind of like the direction or the aim that this text is trying to bring a person or direct a person. And in order to do that, one of the things that becomes important for this tradition is that we understand our own mind. Understand our mind. So there's a number of verses, the whole chapter titled The Mind. And understand both the condition of the mind which is not at peace, the mind that suffers, And also understand the capacity of the mind to discover peace and happiness, to develop itself. So this is a verse that I like, because it's kind of evocative a little bit. The mind, hard to control, flighty, alighting where it wishes, one does well to tame. The disciplined mind brings happiness. Alighting where it wishes. The mind has a mind of its own. Some of you, when you sit down to meditate, understand that. Boy, it's pretty flighty. It's distracted, the monkey mind. The mind, hard to control, flighty. Alighting where it wishes, one does well to tame. The watched mind brings happiness. The watched mind. Cultivating mindfulness. Here's another very powerful image of the monkey mind, maybe. Like a fish out of water, thrown on dry ground, the mind trashes about, trying to escape Mara's command. Has your mind ever been like that? Here's one about kind of pursuing the spiritual life, the life of liberation, in the wrong way. And it talks about different ascetics of the time. Fool, what use is matted hair? What use is a deerskin robe? The tangled jungle is within you, and you groom the outside. So looking in the wrong place. Whatever an enemy may do to an enemy, or haters one to another, far worse is the harm from one's wrongly directed mind. And that's a powerful statement. No matter what someone else might do to you, what we do to ourselves, our wrongly directed mind will be worse. Neither mother nor father nor any other relative can do one as much good as one's own well-directed mind. So we look outside for someone to help us and do things for us. But no one can do as much good for ourselves as we can do as much good for us as we can for ourselves with a well-directed mind. And so this takes practice. So there's a whole series of these verses that focus on cultivating, developing oneself, practicing. And the assumption in this tradition here, in this text, is that the human mind is malleable. We're not stuck with the mind that we were, you know, as it is right now. But it's possible to do religious practice, spiritual practice, a meditation practice, a variety of things. And we can change and shape, develop, cultivate the mind. As I said, the cultivated mind is what's needed to bring peace. And I know plenty of people who think that maybe peace is found just by letting go, letting go, letting go, by not doing. And to some degree that's true. But a mind which hasn't been disciplined or has some inner strength is not going to be able to let go as completely or as realistically or as healthily. So part of this is developing ourselves. So practice. Here's a rationale for practice. If one knew oneself to be precious, one would guard oneself with care. The sage will watch over herself in any part of the night. If one knew oneself to be precious. So again, the warm hand to warm hand tradition, the tradition that we're valuable, we're precious, there's something, there's a treasure, there's something really beautiful in each person. And if we can see that beauty in ourselves, then we would want to protect that, and guard that, watch over it, develop it. Wisdom arises from spiritual practice. Without practice, it decays. Always wide awake are the disciples of Gautama, the Buddha, whose minds constantly, day and night, delight in practice. The next verse is very famous. It's quoted a lot in different kind of ways, different kind of variations of it. It is up to you to make strong effort. The Buddhas merely tell you how. Isn't that good? It's up to you to make strong effort. Teachers merely tell you how. Following the path, those absorbed in meditation will be freed from Mara's bonds. And part of practice is, part of this tradition is not just to do it alone, even though the focus is on one's own mind and cultivating oneself and safeguarding oneself and oneself. It's not an individualistic practice. There is a way of practicing in a community with others and being supported. And in reading these verses, I'm aware that, you know, we're supported by a lineage of, you know, generations and generations of practitioners who brought us this, bring us the teachings. But here's one. Like someone pointing to treasure is the wise person who sees your faults and points them out. Associate with such a sage, good will come of it, not bad. If you associate with such as this, good will come of it, not bad, if you associate with one such as this. So, do you allow people in your life to see your faults, to point them out? Are you open for observation, for comments, for, I noticed something about you. Oh, no. Like someone pointing to a treasure is the wise person who sees your faults and points them out. But then, a little bit different than this, do not consider the faults of others or what they have or haven't done. Consider rather what you yourself have or haven't done. So, in other words, if you're a wise person, a teacher, maybe sometimes you can give people feedback. But don't go around looking at other people's faults. One of my favorite monastic rules for monks is that they have a whole series of rules about how they're supposed to eat out of their bowls, these big bowls. And one of the rules is they're not allowed to look in the other monks' bowls to see how they're eating, if they're following the rules or not. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a corrupted mind, and suffering follows, as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows like a never-departing shadow. So this dichotomy, or this is the fact that the mind precedes it all. The mind is so central in this particular tradition. And to emphasize how central and important the mind is, in the introduction to the book, I compare it to the beginning of Genesis, the beginning of the Bible or the Torah, where there it all begins with God, as far as I could tell. And so that's the beginning. But in Buddhism, these two verses I just read, which are the first two verses of this text, are probably among the verses that qualify, the teachings that qualify, as being the beginning of the Buddhist scriptures. And here it's the mind which is held up as being central. And you get a very different understanding of spiritual life if you start with the mind compared to if you start with God or God. And so there's kind of interesting kind of contrast and differences between theistic religions and non-theistic. It isn't that Buddhism is non-theistic. I think of it as being not theocentric. And so to say it's atheistic is not quite accurate. To say it's theistic is not really accurate either. But it's not theocentric. In a sense, you could say it's anthrocentric, people-centric. But that bothers some people to call it that. So here, the mind takes precedence, and what you do has consequences. So if you speak and act with a corrupted mind, suffering will follow. And here's a very important equation, that there's something about suffering that arises in the result of how your mind has been. And then it goes on to say, happiness arises from a peaceful mind. And the analogies here, the images, the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox for suffering. Speaker act with a corrupted mind, and suffering follows as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox. Imagine an ox with a really heavy wagon of goods, pulling it, straining, sweating. It's a big burden to pull this heavy wagon. So speaker act with a corrupted mind, and suffering, this heavy suffering burden, will follow you. But then imagine a never-departing shadow. You go along, you have a shadow behind you. You're walking along, and the shadow doesn't weigh anything. And there is no burden to be, you know, bring your shadow along with you. Speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows like a never-departing shadow. So your happiness is not a burden. It's just there in a light way. Not by silence does an ignorant fool become a sage. This tradition, this text has a lot of discussion about the wise person and the foolish person. And kind of a little bit seemed odd to me when I came across it. It seems kind of derogatory or negative to call someone a fool. And there's a whole chapter called The Fool and a whole chapter called The Sage. And that way of looking at people is part of the tradition. And it's when I reflect on it, I think it's very different than calling people saints or sinners. If you're a fool, you can become wise, maybe. And then it said once, one of the verses says, "A fool that knows he's a fool is to that degree wise." Not by silence does an ignorant fool become a sage. The wise person, who, as if holding a set of scales, selects what's good and avoids what's evil, is for that reason a sage. So the ability to be discerning, in a healthy way discriminating, between different options, different choices we make, and be able to see the differences, and then be able to choose between those differences, is part of the criteria, part of the definition of a wise person in this tradition. And then with practice comes insights, understandings, wisdom. And I want to give you, share a few of them that I like. Ancient is the saying. Ancient is the saying. I like this one too. Even before the Buddha, there was wisdom teachings. And this warm hand to warm hand, you know, started before him. He received it as well from others. Ancient is the saying. It is not just of today. They find fault in one sitting silently. They find fault in one speaking much. They find fault in one speaking moderately. No one in this world is not found at fault. Doesn't that help you be more equanimous? That's for me. Well, you know. And no one can be found who has been, is, or will be only criticized or only praised. So what do you do then? How do you keep your peace and your calm, your stability, when you're criticized and praised? It's built into this life that sooner or later will happen. And if you stay silent and don't say anything at all, not by silence does an ignorant fool become a sage. So it's a risky business. Open your mouth. Here's another little kind of small wisdom thing. And I like the image of it. Not even with a shower of gold coins. So they didn't have the California lottery back then. Not even with a California lottery. Not even with a shower of gold coins would we find satisfaction in sensual craving. People threatened by fear go to many refuges, to mountains, forests, parks, trees, and shrines. None of these is a secure refuge. None is a supreme refuge. Not by going to such a refuge is one released from all suffering. But here again, people are looking outside of themselves for safety. So here they're talking about going into nature, But people go out, you know, all kinds of places. People go outside of themselves to be safe. But when someone going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha sees with right insight the Four Noble Truths, suffering, the arising of suffering, the overcoming of suffering, and the Eightfold Path leading to the ending of suffering, then this is the secure refuge, this is the supreme refuge, by going to such a refuge, one is released from all suffering. So this is the key insight of Buddhism. For happiness, for peace, for liberation from suffering, it's the insight into the Four Noble Truths. And then with practice and insight, then comes realization. And this text is not, this ancient tradition is not about just an abstract ideas. These ideas are there because are to help us be transformed, be changed in some way. And we're talking about individual transformations, change, growth, development at the heart of this. And with these ideals of happiness and peace as being kind of like the you know, keeps being emphasized as the it's not a strange, transcendent, you know, metaphysical or supernatural kind of idea. It's something that's kind of, I think hopefully all of you have some sense, some experience of some degree of happiness and peace. And here we're developing it to a great degree, so it becomes a common part of our life. And what I like about these goals of happiness and peace is you become peaceful by being peaceful. You know, so you start, you know, you start living that way more and more. But anyway, realization, or at some point it becomes realized inside of us, with us. Let go. So here are some of the insights or experiences of realization. Let go of the past. Let go of the future. And let go of the present. Gone beyond becoming, with a mind released in every way, you do not again undergo birth and old age. So we release the mind from all things we cling to, even the present moment. Then we no longer going through these cycles of self-identity, self-identification, becoming, craving, wanting, building up, breaking down. For someone at the journey's end, freed of sorrow, liberated in all ways, released from all bonds, no fever exists. How's your temperature? No fever exists. Whoever is unopposing among those who oppose, peaceful among the violent, not clinging among those who cling, I call a Brahman. The Buddha redefined. Brahman was like the highest caste in ancient India. And the Buddha redefined caste, in a sense, by saying, you know, you don't become a Brahman by birth. You become by your behavior and your inner heart and mind. It's being peaceful. Fearless, free of craving, and without blemish, having reached the goal and destroyed the arrows of becoming, one is in one's final body. Fearless, free of craving, and without blemish. Those who fully cultivate the factors of awakening, give up grasping, enjoy non-clinging, and having destroyed the toxins, are luminous and completely liberated in this life. I like this line, enjoy non-clinging. Is that okay with you? When's the last time you enjoyed it? There is no happiness higher than peace. Nirvana is the foremost happiness. There is no happiness higher than peace. So peace is held up very high. And nirvana is the foremost happiness. So nirvana and peace are considered synonymous. A monk, filled with delight and pleased with the Buddha's teachings, attains happiness, the stilling of formations, the state of peace. if I'm permitted to rephrase it, when you are filled with the light and pleased with the Buddha's teachings, you will attain happiness, the stilling of formations, the state of peace. So I hope that you get filled with the light. And I don't know what it's like to have listened to all these verses this morning. I find it quite nice myself to kind of review, kind of be reminded of these periodically, and have them kind of, you know, one a day sometimes kind of drift through and inform my day. And I take the light in these teachings. I take the light in the lineage. I take the light in the tradition that's held them and supported them and made them part of my life. And and I take the light in whatever sense I have of liberation, of freedom. And one of the, I didn't find it easily, but there's a verse in here, in a couple of places I think, where it talks about someone who's liberated has nothing. And I just love that. Has nothing. So, may you have to take delight in the possibility of having nothing. And in doing that, may you be a warm hand that brings warmth to the hands of others. I think that for me, a big part of all this is not just for ourselves here, but also so we can continue passing on, not necessarily Buddhism, that's kind of incidental in some ways, but rather passing on the happiness, the peace, the possibility, the warmth, and spreads from us and goes out into the world. May we all continue the warm hand to warm hand. Thank you very much.